Bringing Hip Hop to the Arts Center and a movie remembering an era of Miami Beach long forgotten. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. This weekend, the Arts Center will be presenting a special performance of The Last Jimmy. It's a hip-hop musical by rapper Dice Raw, formerly of The Roots. It's a show that looks at Jim Crow in the 21st century. A musical, not along the lines of Hamilton, but more like the movie Straight Outta Compton. Dice Raw will join us. This week is the start of the 2018 Jewish Film Festival. There will be 60 movies available over the next couple of weeks. We spoke to the directors of The Last Resort, a documentary about two photographers who captured life in Miami Beach in the 1970s. All of that coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, this weekend, the Adrian Arts Center is presenting The Last Jimmy, a contemporary hip-hop musical that explores mass incarcerations and the ills of the criminal justice system in America.
Jimmy, my son. Misery comes in all flavors, but chocolate's preferred. But the question is, do I look mean enough? Scary. Do I look mean and bad and super bad and super scary enough? What you looking at? Too much eye contact. Now somebody got to die.
When you look at me, what do you see? An animal. When you lock me up, throw away the key, I'm no animal. You only become what you believe, and I'm no animal. Behind those gates and those closed doors, sitting in a cell, I know I'm more than an animal. I'm a human being, there's no difference.
The Last Jimmy was created by five-time Grammy-nominated rapper Carl Dice Raw Jenkins of the legendary Roots Crew of Philadelphia. The Last Jimmy was inspired by Jimmy's Back, Dice Raw's second solo album, which was inspired also by Dr. Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. Now, The Last Jimmy presents Dice Raw as the main character, Jimmy, and uses hip-hop and dance to address the crisis of black male mass incarceration in America with the intent to transform the perception that we have of young African-Americans in the inner cities. Joining me right now in studio is Dice Raw. It is a pleasure, man. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Man, the pleasure is all mine. Thanks for having me.
You know what? The Last Jimmy, the musical, all started in 2013, right when your album Jimmy's Back had come out, and that was inspired by the book, as I mentioned, The New Jim Crow. What's the story you're trying to tell with this show?
You know, that's a good question. The Last Jimmy, it actually tells a lot of different stories, which is all telling one story. So inside mass incarceration and privatized prisons, which is the main inspiration for this Last Jimmy, there are other things that come into effect that lead people down a path of criminality. And some of it is peer pressure. Some of it is, you know, home situation, the disconnect between black fathers and black sons, growing up angry, emotions, not having control of them. Education plays a big part in these things. And then there's choice, you know. So there's a lot of different things that, you know, covered in The Last Jimmy that actually focus on one main issue.
You know, the whole show takes place. I mean, we start with Jimmy in a jail cell, and almost all of it takes place in a courtroom. Who's Jimmy? Who is he?
Well, that's a good question, too. Well, Jimmy is the last black man to be free. So I read an article one time, and it said that at the rate that African-Americans and actually Latino-Americans are being arrested, that if it kept going in the rate it was going, that there wouldn't be any blacks free. You know, so this is like the last one. So he's the last African-American male to be free in like the not so near future. In the near future, you know what I'm saying? and he's on trial for past, present, and future crimes.
There was a character in the show that comes out very quickly, and I was fascinated by this character, the crier. And he's in blackface. Who is this guy, and why is he in blackface?
Well, the blackface is actually his punishment and for actually being that character and to keep the character going. Because, you know, minstrel characters come from an era when black actors and actresses weren't allowed to be in film or TV or theater or anything like that. So white actors would approximate black person by putting on blackface. And that then carried on into actual black culture with black actors being allowed to be in theater and movies and television, approximating that. And I still feel like some artists are still doing that. So that's their punishment. That's the character, the crier's punishment, is to read every case for this particular courtroom.
I mean, there are times when it seems like, you know, he brings a comedy to the story. He's funny, but also really poignant moments too. He's pointing out the obvious a lot of the times, you know. And then there's a powerful moment in the show when he's wearing white gloves and he takes the black face off of his face with the white glove. What's that moment mean?
That's like an awakening. That's from, you know, locking into a certain idea and a certain narrative and allowing yourself to shed that narrative and become something new. You know, so it's like he's a coon character is what you would typically call him. But I like to think of him as a cocoon, you know, because he transforms. You know, he starts off one way and then he watches the case. He sees what's going on and he actually has a moment of like, you know what? I think I'm done with this. And I think a lot of artists are doing that now. They're taking off. They're transforming. They're taking off the mask of the narrative that's been painted for a lot of African American males, and that we were actually wearing as like a badge too. Like, okay, we are the gangsters. We are the face of criminality in America, and we're proud of that. I can go from this level of poverty in these particular situations and transform and be a mogul or a hip hop. Like a hip hop mogul, but you know, that has happened for some people, but not for a lot of people. You know what I'm saying? And the transformation is important. When you see somebody go from, okay, I'm a gangster, and now, you know what? I think I want to leave that narrative in the past, and I want to become something else. And I think that's great.
Where did you find, or how did you find Dr. Alexander's book?
It was given to me by a very good friend of mine's, and he's a tastemaker in Philly, and you know he actually is a partner at Pipeline Workspace, and where a lot of people come together. And he gave me the book, and then he called me an hour later and asked me if I read it. And I said, well, I didn't read it yet. And he said, okay. So he called me back like 3 hours later. He's like, yo, so what you think? I was like, I didn't read it yet. And so he just kept calling me, kept calling me. So I just decided to just read it. So I went, you know, got the audio book, and I listened to it, and I read some of the book, and I was blown away by it.
The New Jim Crow.
The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, yeah.
After it's over, I mean, what are you thinking about? Because this, again, leads to, you know, your inspiration for this show. But, I mean, afterwards, what's going through your mind?
What went through my mind was how I feel like the way that she broke down the judicial system escaped me. And I realized that I was thinking in the case that, you know, the criminal lifestyle was normal for some people, you know, and if someone goes to jail, then they're in jail for a reason kind of thing. And I was still kind of like caught up into that, you know, because I knew so many people that are incarcerated and I knew the system was corrupt, but I didn't know how corrupt it was. I didn't really understand how systematic it was. And after I just sat and I just thought about how much work she put into this book. And I was like, is there anything I can do to help? You know what I mean? So I wanted to do Jimmy's Back, the album.
Yeah, I mean, and like, you know, at that point, did you start working on it right away?
Or? I did. I really did. And I boarded, like I was talking about these guys earlier, I had used ex-offenders to tell their story. Because I was like, you know, I don't want to just be a person who's talking about incarceration and never been incarcerated, because I've never been incarcerated. I've been arrested a few times, but what black male, I mean, in America really hasn't, you know. But so I let these ex-offenders come in and tell their story on Jimmy's Back, and it was just an interesting perspective, because I would start a song, like one song is called Looking Glass, and to me it was just about self-reflection and looking at one's life and trying to make, you know, some different choices. And the other guy, he interpreted it as the looking glass when he was looking at his family through the glass, and he was in jail for 15 years from his daughter's birth to when she was 15. And he said, I just remember different times I would see her when she was growing up. And he said, I basically watched her become a woman behind the glass. He's like, you know, when she had her period and all these different things, he said he had to talk to her through a phone, and he wasn't there to help her or go through any of these life issues. And he just said, you know, the looking glass was him looking at his family through this clear glass. It wasn't the mirror at all, you know. And I thought that was just a whole interesting take on what my original thought was.
I don't know if you know this. I just found out a little while ago that that book had at one point just briefly been banned in two prisons in New Jersey. Yeah. And they lifted the ban.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. What do you think about that? That's
I find that very interesting, because what was the point of them banning it in the first place? Like, who put it on the ban list? Was it terroristic, or was it, you know, it was definitely an eye opener, because one of the guys that I work with on the Jimmy's Back project, he had been incarcerated for 8 years. And since we worked on a project together, he's then transformed his life, because he came to a realization. You know, I gave them the book, and some of them read it, and he says, you know what? He says, I thought it was me. He said, I thought something was wrong with me and why I kept getting arrested. And he says, but they're actually targeting me. He says, you know, he says, I got locked up at one spot at 6 o'clock on a Tuesday night, got out a year later, 2 weeks out, I got locked up Tuesday night, 6 o'clock in the same spot, same time. Because they were doing something called stop and frisk.
Mm. Your album, Jimmy's Back, comes out 2013, mm-hmm. late 2013. That's a year after the shooting and killing of Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. A year later, the killings of Eric Gardner and Michael Brown. You know what? Look, from an outsider's perspective, all right, as a Latino man, I mean, I see all this, and there's all this conversation going on, and I'm glad it's going on. But for you, as an African-American man, what those few years, what's going on? How do you see it?
To me, I see something that has been happening from the conception of Ku Klux Klan infiltrating law enforcement, and it's not anything new. The sad part about what you just mentioned is that when we first did this play, Trayvon Martin was the only name that was in it. And since then, we've had to add a dozen names. And that's just showing us that the problem is just getting worse. Now, we just got to think about all of these incidents that happened before this technology of cell phones and Twitter and all this in a way where people couldn't get riled up or express their voices collectively. You know, it's been going on for so long. It's been going on for years. And you as a Latino male, you're definitely affected by this too, because that train's never late. You know, as soon as they run out of blacks, they're like, okay, let's find some Puerto Ricans. You know what I'm saying? Let's find some Mexicans. Let's find some Cubans. And, you know, like Latino women since 1999 have been arrested at the rate of 400% a spike in their arrest. So it's a societal issue. You know what I'm saying? Like, we can see the society's broken in certain different places. And it's like, well, how come we aren't fixing that? You know, how come we aren't fixing that? It's like, well, black males are being incarcerated at a high rate. Why? What are the crimes? What are most of the crimes? Oh, most of the crimes are marijuana offenses. Oh, well, but marijuana is almost legal, right? Yeah, well, for some people, but not for some people. It's like, well, wait a minute. Can't we fix that? You know, I was in court for a character witness. One of my friends thought that I would be some kind of help as a character witness. He obviously wasn't really thinking that through. So he has me come through to be a character witness to speak on his behalf in the courtroom. As I was sitting in the courtroom, I watched about 6 cases go by. One of the cases was over $27 worth of marijuana. The prosecutor was asking for the full extent of the law. And the judge said, for $27 worth of marijuana? So he had to, like, look through his paperwork. The judge was like, well, what is that? You know? And the lawyer looked at his paperwork. He says, 3 to 5 years in jail, Your Honor. And the judge was like, for $27 worth of marijuana? He says, you know, I just can't justify that. He says, you know, look, kids, stay away from, you know, weed. He says, well, why are you pressing that? He said, well, Your Honor, he had it individually bagged, which means that was intent to sell. that wasn't for his use. $27. 3 to 5 years in jail.
Yeah, we've seen that story a lot. Of course, we've also seen cities, at least down here in South Florida, trying to not legalize, but just reduce the sentences, reduce the punishment for tiny amounts like that. Again, talking with Carl Dicerall Jenkins, talking about his new show, The Last Jimmy, playing at the Arts Center. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk more about the show and the inspiration behind it. And I'm going to talk a little bit of hip-hop and rap with him, too. Why not? All of that coming up on Sundial here on WLRN.
Prosecution is speaking right now. If your client has something to say, let him say it.
Teachers couldn't reach him. Preachers said it's no reason to try. Because God, it's something he believes in. His family members said he's nothing but a heathen. You let him run the streets and he'll be dead by the evening. He's hustling, struggling, in and out of jail. Got shot up 3 times and got a bun in the oven. It's 10 years later and he still ain't learned nothing.
Objection, objection,
that boy's
objection.
Good.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and that is a piece from the show The Last Jimmy, playing at the Adrian Arts Center this weekend. And the creator of The Last Jimmy and also starring in The Last Jimmy is Dicerall, and he's joining me in studio. That was a fascinating piece, and it goes to back what you were saying. We're talking about lawyers and trying to seek the ultimate punishment. And here's this prosecutor in the show, and I thought what was interesting was not just that he's trying to go after Jimmy for crimes, but he's even saying he's guilty of crimes he's going to commit in the future. And he straight up says it. He's guilty because he's black.
Yes. I mean, well, you got to think about that. As black males being the face of criminality in America, we are guilty of crimes that we haven't even committed yet. You know, Dave Chappelle said that he was on an airplane and the plane's 30,000 feet in the air and a woman grabbed her purse like he was about to snatch it and then jump out of the airplane.
I remember that, yes.
So, I mean, that right there just says it all. You know, the way that criminals are actually painted in America, too, or people who go into prison, they're painted with such a wide brush that you miss the people who get caught up in the system, those in-between guys who then have the same record as these guys who've done, I mean, heinous crimes and should be punished. They fall into that same loop and they get painted with that brush too. And they all have that mark on them, you know, as they go through society, even though they want to change. Like, I know a lot of people have been incarcerated and I never once heard anyone say, when I get out of jail, I can't wait to get back to selling drugs. I just never heard that. I can't wait to get back to being in armed robberies. I can't wait to get back to, you know, whatever it was that they were doing to get incarcerated. I just never heard that. And I always hear regret, always hear remorse, always hear sadness, you know, a life wasted, you know, those type of things. How do I get my life back? Got to get my life back. Got to get my life on track. I'll do anything. I'll hand out menus for a Chinese restaurant. I'll do anything, you know. And I think when a person is at that level of remorse, they should be given a chance. And we should be able to distinctively find these people who are actually looking for the help and not paint them with that same brush that they've been painted with already. You know, they've already got the mark on them and they're trying to get the mark off. Let's not give them another one if we don't have to.
You worked on this play with Philip S. Brown.
Oh yeah.
What's the collaboration like?
The collaboration with Phil is always very, very interesting because he's so passionate. You know, the reason why I like working with him is he always puts his message first, you know, before the storyline. He's like, okay, well, what is this about? This is not just about a hip-hop musical. I don't want to do anything that is just going to be fluff. I want to do something that's going to have some meat on the bone, and that's going to be able to affect people and touch people in a different dynamic. And that's why it's layered in with not just Jimmy as a gangster, but it's him as wanting to change from that. It's also peppered in with the relationship with his father, you know, a disconnect between father and son, which a lot of people can relate to outside of black, Latino, white, whoever, you know, Asian. Parents are people, too, and they make mistakes and do things that as children we might not understand, you know. And in this case, Jimmy's father has been incarcerated and he's basically almost continuing his cycle. I spoke to a kid today who told me his father is incarcerated.
Yeah, you were at some schools, right?
Yeah, I was at a few schools today. We went to Young Men's Prep, I believe. We went to, I don't know their names, but, you know.
Yeah,
Coral Reef High School.
How old were the kids? Oh, so they're high schoolers?
Yeah, high school kids. Okay. Yeah, definitely. And a lot of them had a different perspective and they had like interesting questions. I spoke to like a group of white students today, well, mostly white. And they had a lot of interesting questions. They were like, well, what does the character of blackface mean? And like kind of like what you were saying. And, you know, they were like, well, why does society look at black males like that? You know, so. And you know, the question is, I mean, the answer to that question is, it's easy.
Yeah.
It's easy.
You know what? I wanted to ask you about what's interesting is, so this it's bringing in hip hop and dance into the show. Okay, so we've heard people talk about Lin-Manuel Miranda bringing hip-hop to Broadway. Oh, yeah. with Hamilton and the show In the Heights before that, but this is so different. This and what jumped out to me were like movies like Boys in the Hood. I remember growing up watching that, mm-hmm. and Straight Outta Compton, which was recently. This is a lot more raw. It's a lot deeper than, I guess, what you would see in a Hamilton. But, you know, you've had the chance to do theater. What do you see as the future of theater and hip-hop? They seem to work well together.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, like you said, like, this is definitely different than Hamilton, but I thought Hamilton was great. You know what I'm saying?
I haven't had the chance to see it. Don't give it away.
Okay, I'm not going to give it away. It's hard to give it away anyway. But Hamilton was great, and I think Lin is brilliant. And the way that he was able to use an idea that's typically taught in an educational kind of forum, which is like a boring part of white history, you know what I'm saying? And he was able to flip it into this bright, imaginative thing. And I think that we're definitely going to see more of that. The Last Jimmy, of course, is hardcore hip hop. You know, this is as hardcore as it can get. And they were actually doing some talkbacks at the Adrian to talk about the language and, you know, prepare people for the images like you spoke about earlier. And
the show is Friday and Saturday.
Friday and Saturday, yeah.
All right. I want to keep going with you, but we got to stop because of time. I just noticed, again, talking with Carl Dice Raw Jenkins, again, about his show, The Last Jimmy, playing at the Adrian Arts Center Friday and Saturday. More information on our website. It was I got to see the preview of the show. I got a preview of the show. It was really powerful, really raw, really awesome. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here, man.
Man, thank you, Louis. Appreciate you.
All right. More coming up on Sundial today, the start of the Miami Jewish Film Festival. We'll tell you all about it. That's next here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, tonight is the kickoff of the 2018 Miami Jewish Film Festival. There are 60 films available for fans of independent and documentary movies. One of those films is The Last Resort. It's a documentary about photographers Andy Sweet and Greg Monroe and the project they worked on together to document the Jewish community in Miami Beach in the 1970s. I spoke with Igor Sterenberg, executive director, and Dennis Scholl and Kareem Tapsch, both co-directors of The Last Resort. Let's go to that conversation.
We revitalized the brand. We were able to find a niche within our community. And mind you, we started running this festival at a time when the entire arts community in South Florida was just finding a new resurgence. It was flourishing. More art houses were present than ever before. And we were finding great new partnerships to align our interests so that we were able to develop new audiences, reach new crowds that we previously were just not tapping into. And the quality of our programming was just very distinct. My first year, we presented a film called Ida, which very few Jewish film festivals touched at the time. Given my background is not running Jewish film festivals, but is just quite clearly being a film lover, I just decided to take a chance on this title. And that became a film that went on to win the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. So it set a precedent.
Why did you believe that Miami could be such an important place for a festival like this?
Well, because I'm a film lover. And Miami is full of film lovers. And it's not just our film festival that's flourishing. It's the entire arts community is flourishing. We're all doing it at the same time. There's natural synergy. And instead of just trying to fly solo, what we decided to do was just to find friendships. And the O Cinema, the Coral Gables Art Cinema, the Miami Beach Cinema Tech, you know, the Bill Cosford Cinema, all these art houses became just our champions to not just have a festival that runs for 10 days out of the year, but one that is functional throughout the entire year.
Let's discuss this upcoming festival. How many films are going to be available for the audience to choose from?
There's going to be over 60 movies, therefore over 70-plus events that our film lovers are going to be able to just have the joy of sitting down and kind of doing all their schedule calculations to decide how they want to spend the rest of their week. There's enough for everyone. There's something for everyone.
And you briefly touched on, you know, how you made the choices in the past of some of the films you brought in. With the films that you have for this upcoming film festival, you know, was there anything special about any of them that stand out for you? What went into the process of picking these?
So looking back, some of the distinct things this festival has done that allowed it to continue to grow were, one, that we just decided to have a commitment to programming excellence. That's one. So we take chances on films that regular Jewish film festivals would just possibly pass on. We want to take those risks. Two, we started a short film competition in partnership with a film distributor, U.S. film distributor, and the winning film would receive a distribution deal. That's another thing Jewish film festivals not regularly known for. And then last year, what we initiated was a commitment to accompanying our film from premieres with live performances. So we had a screening of a film, a dance-themed documentary, and we had a live dance performance on stage, followed by a screening, which is kind of maddening and crazy, but it was so wildly successful that we decided to just even further it this year. And we're presenting some films that are definitely musical-themed, such as Itzhak Perlman, a documentary about him, this visionary violinist, one of the greatest living violinists. And there's going to be a string quartet performance of some of the songs that he's most well-known for performing. And then we're going to do something we've never done before, just taking a totally other risk, shooting the moon, if you will. We're doing a screening of the iconic French animated film Fantastic Planet, and we're accompanying it with a live score. So you will be seeing art take place as you're watching the film.
Wow. Now, one of the films is The Last Resort, and we have the two directors here with us briefly. But describe it just briefly for folks who don't know it, The Last Resort.
I think it's a fascinating, touching, and utterly tantalizing documentary about an unknown photographer who tapped into the heart and soul of our Miami Beach community and captured a time and a place unlike anyone has ever seen before. And this is a documentary that kind of brings this to life. It's an extraordinary revelation of a film.
Dennis Scholl, you are the CEO of Arts Center South Florida, the former vice president for Arts of the Night Foundation. You've made films. You created the film Deep City, The Birth of the Miami Sound. But what brought you to this project, The Last Resort?
Well, my co-director and I, Kareem Tabbs, who everybody knows in this town as one of the co-founders of O Cinema, he and I wanted to make a film together. I'd made a number of films, including Deep City. Thank you, WLRN, for producing that with us. We're much, much appreciative of that. But Kareem and I sat down one day and started talking about Miami stories because we both had come to the conclusion that this community is finally beginning to tell its stories. And they're starting to do it in documentary form. And we wanted to lead the way with that. We want to be Miami's documentarians. And so we began to talk about stories we knew. My preference in making films is to make art films, films about culture. And we came to Andy and Gary's story almost immediately. I grew up down here. I knew Andy a little bit when he was alive, and I still know Gary to this day. And we thought, boy, this is really a story that, particularly for a millennial generation who thinks South Beach always was about clubs and ultra and those kinds of things, people didn't know this story. It was starting to kind of fade and disappear, just like the elderly, retired Jewish population of South Beach had disappeared. So we got to the conclusion right away that this was the first thing we wanted to do together.
And Kareem Tapsch, you launched O Cinema. You're one of the two directors of this film. How did you find this story? And you're talking about Andy and Gary, the two photographers, you know, whose story you're telling. But they were also telling it. You're telling a story within a story here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, their work has been rediscovered a lot across the last several years. I came across the Washington Post had done an article a few years ago, and it was a big cover story in the New Times. So it actually is just a seed that was planted in the back of my mind. And as Dennis said, we'd been looking for opportunities to collaborate. And I think quite quickly we both said, Andy Sweet, Gary Monroe. and said, "Yeah, that's when we're going to do it." And really, with that easy of a decision process as far as collaborating on the film. But also being someone who's a Miami native, there's a few of us left still. It was an exciting look at at an era that really kind of ended before I came into adulthood. I have very vague recollections of some of the elderly in South Beach. But that's all they were, vague recollections, and you hear the stories, and my mother would talk about going to see the old people dancing on South Beach. And then you discover this amazing body of work that documented it and did it so beautifully. It really dictated to us that it needed to be made into a film.
You're listening to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. And this is a previous conversation that I had with Igor Sterenberg, executive director of the Miami Jewish Film Festival, and Dennis Scholl and Kareem Tapsch, both co-directors of the documentary The Last Resort.
One of the things about this movie that I found most profound was the fact that Gary and Andy understood that this is a moment in history they have to document. And it is about the Jewish community living in South Beach in the 70s, because they understood this is going to go away at some point, so they have to get this now. But real briefly, describe to folks, what they're going to see in the film as to what South Beach was like in the 70s. Dennis, go ahead.
Well, there are two parts of the film that I think will really lay it out. One is a section which we simply identify the porch sitters, because that was the primary social thing to do on South Beach. So you got up in the morning, you had your breakfast, and you went out and you sat on the porch of your Ocean Drive Hotel, your Collins Avenue Hotel. The second one, which we love very, very much, is Andy Sweet and Gary Monroe began to photograph New Year's Eve on South Beach. And every hotel had a party for New Year's Eve. And they would go to as many as 50 of these parties on New Year's Eve photographing. Interestingly enough, because of the audience, everything was over by about 10 o'clock, unfortunately.
What? We keep mentioning Andy and Gary. Kareem, real briefly, who are Andy and Gary?
Andy Sweet and Gary Monroe were sons of Miami Beach, who born and raised on the beach, and started in photography very young. Went away to college. Coincidentally, both went to the University of South Florida in Tampa, became friends, and decided to go to UC Boulder and pursue a master's degree, and jointly decided that the community that which they came from, that was thriving and alive with this wonderful Jewish culture, was coming to an end in the near future, and they decided that they were going to document it. And they did so beautifully.
They did beautifully, and wow, what a contrast in styles.
Yeah.
Dennis, the photographs are either in black and white and color. Gary had his style. It was black and white. Andy loved color. How would you describe the differences in their styles? And what, not just in the fact they were using black and white and color, but also how they composed shots?
So as somebody who's collected photography for many, many years, I was intrigued when I finally sat down and began to lay these photographs next to each other. And we do that in the film, too. We'll show you a photograph of Gary's, and then we'll show you a photograph of Andy's. And yes, Gary shot in black and white, and Andy shot in super saturated color. But Gary also was a classic photographer. Everything was composed. He would take his time. He would outline a shot. He was very, his Leica was always ready. Andy would kind of bop along the street, see something he liked, pick up his camera and go, boop, boop, that was it. And just grab these shots. And yet he was able to capture people in a way that they were almost unaware of what was happening. The other thing that was interesting, and Gary talks about this in the film, Andy was a whiz in the lab. He'd go in there with 50 sheets of paper and photographic paper, and he'd come out with 48 prints. No photographer does that. So everything about it was almost whimsical to Andy and intense and driven for Gary. And you feel that from Gary in the film. You feel how hard he's had to work to be a great photographer. And that's just an issue. It's just there.
And a difference in personalities as well, Kareem. I mean, were they close?
Yeah, I think that their work is indicative of them as people. They are vastly different one to another in style, and their approach to kind of life is also different. They were very close. They became friends at college, and they had a great synergy in working together. But they had completely different styles and completely different approaches to photography. And I think it complemented each other quite well. And the result is really one of the most complete documentations of a community that we've ever seen.
All right. I know that it's probably not fair to ask this question, but do you have a favorite photograph from the entire collection, either from Andy or from Gary? Kareem?
I think every time I see another photograph, it becomes my next favorite. There's really just so much, and they're so remarkable. There's a picture of a couple on South Beach. It's an Andy Sweet photograph of an elderly couple in matching purple bathing suits on the beach and kind of in a dance-held embrace. And that one really kind of, to me, it's the epitome of his work. The color, the kookiness to it, because there's a quirk, but also the heart in it that comes through when you see it. And you look at that, and all of that comes through at once. And I think it's almost the best representation of Andy's work. But you ask me tomorrow, and I'll have a different answer.
And no doubt, as mentioned, too, just the color, such saturated color, but it's just so vibrant. Dennis, for you, Dennis, what did you have a photograph that jumped out at you?
Well, there's a beautiful photograph of a woman wearing a brown velour pantsuit, which I'm old enough to remember those. And she's wearing a wig. And we just assumed that she was an Orthodox woman wearing a wig. But we found out once the Andy Sweet Photo Legacy Facebook site started to put some of the photos up, they got contacted by somebody who said, that was my aunt. And she was wearing that wig because she was going through chemotherapy and radiation. And so that photograph really resonates with me. This is a strong, powerful woman who's really facing a big challenge. And it just comes through the photo right away. Now, Gary has a photo that we use in the film that's also, I think, amazing. It's very late in the project, and Gary is photographing the last groups of elderly Jewish retirees on South Beach. And as he goes to click the frame, a young Haitian man in a bicycle rides into the frame. And you're thinking to yourself, oh, my gosh, you're telling a decade story in 1/250th of a second. And it really is that.
And again, you've been listening to a previous conversation that I had with Igor Sterenberg, executive director of the Miami Jewish Film Festival, which starts tonight. We also heard from Dennis Scholl and Kareem Tapsch, co-directors of the documentary The Last Resort. We'll have more on this conversation coming up on Sundial here on WLRN.
One of my favorite photographs is this three women that are in bathing suits, and they're probably over 40, but they're really loving themselves and they're confident. And it shows beauty in a very natural way, not an unnatural way, like no Botox in those days. These were real, real buxom ladies with real boobs and real bodies. It's important for us to have that legacy from him of seeing people the way they really were.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. And that's a cut from the film The Last Resort. It's a documentary about two photographers who documented the life of people living in Miami Beach in the 1970s, specifically the Jewish community. Dennis Scholl and Kareem Tapsch are co-directors of the film. We also had Igor Sterenberg, the executive director of the Miami Jewish Film Festival, which starts tonight. Let's go back to that conversation. Igor, what does this movie teach us about Miami, teach us about being Miamians? What did you gather from it?
I think that what made this film particularly special is in the way that these photographers were able to frame this community, is the sincerity with which they were living. There is an honesty and a joy in the spirit with which they passed their days. And I think that that is still inherent to many Miamians, to many of our neighbors, to our family, who call themselves, you know, the 305. And I think that that's what makes Miami so special as a city, too. Outside Miami, we're looked upon as the Wild Wild West, right? Very different from the rest of the United States. And I think that there's that spontaneous joy that Andy was able to capture in these incredibly vibrant photographs. And I think that Gary similarly was able to frame them through his own aesthetic.
Again, this is a movie that tells us two stories, really, or at least I gathered. One, I'm getting this view of Miami Beach from an era that I wasn't here for. And so I got to see this incredible, view, like going through a time machine that I probably never would have gotten anywhere else. But it's also the story of these two guys, of Andy and Gary, and their relationship and their work. And it has a sad turn. Let me start with the story of Gary and Andy. One of them, you can tell, I think, Dennis, as you mentioned, Gary had a very certain style of how he composed his photographs, and it almost seemed that's how he composed his life. Andy almost seemed as though his style of photographing really was indicative of his style of living.
No, I think that's fair. I think that they lived very different lives, and Andy was more somebody who was interested in taking a walk on the wild side, if you will. You know, so, you know, Miami is a big urban party town, and you know, Andy got involved in that, and Gary, as he says, he would get up at 5:30 and go to bed at 9 p.m. He never saw, you know, a late night program, and so despite that, they were able to work together, and despite their differences in style, they knew how important this project was, not just to them but to our community and to photography in general. Documenting a subculture is a big commitment. It doesn't happen in a day or 3 days. And other artists started to come around. Mary Ellen Mark, the very well-known photographer, came down and began to work with Andy on taking photographs on South Beach. So they were very different people, and yet they were able to meld their styles enough to work together to create work that, when you look at it together, you get a real feel for the subculture. One of Gary's really beautiful moments in the film is again when the South Beach began to unravel post Mario Boatlift, post McDuffie riots. It was dangerous down there, and it was lonely. And there is a series of photos in the film of just pure loneliness. And when you think about a photographer who composes so carefully, I mean, it's poignant. You watch it and you really feel, since it's the Jewish Film Fest, I'll say, you feel verklempt.
The story ends sadly for Andy. Perhaps it is the lifestyle that he chooses leads to really a very tragic end. But I want to ask about his work, because there was an interesting point in the story where Gary understood. He understood early on, like, we have to protect the work. And this obviously didn't sit well with Andy's family. But what ended up happening to Andy's work, Kareem? How many photographs did he have? How many were lost?
It's hard to say how many were lost. You know, Andy's life came to a tragic and unexpected end. And the family was so besieged with their sorrow that they really didn't know how to respond and couldn't really even think about what to do with his body of work. Eventually, they put the work in storage, the work being his negatives, where his master, you know, where all the prints would derive from, and kind of just set it and forget it, would pay the bill, and, you know, and eventually they would get to doing something with his work. But again, they, you know, just all of the feelings of depression for many years really took their toll on them, until one day they noticed that they stopped getting billed at the storage facility. And as we learn in the film, his negatives, his entire body of work, disappeared. And it was like a second death. For many years, that's it. They thought there was, you know, Andy's gone and his work is gone and all we'll have are the memories. Until, fast forward many years later, when by happenstance, they come across some test prints. These are prints that Andy was doing tests of before he made the final edition. And thanks to Stan Hughes, Andy's brother-in-law, and the advent of digital technology and Photoshop, he realized that he was able to bring these back to life, if you will, and thus bring Andy back to life.
From the storage unit, were all of those prints lost, the negatives lost, or is anything recovered?
All of Andy's negatives were lost. Nothing remained. There was a handful of prints that the family had in display in the home. But the thought was that his entire work was gone. For several years, when the family goes to, I believe they're when they're going to sell their home or reorganize, they find some boxes of test prints. Now, these test prints are works that Andy had been testing color and exposure on before he made his final print. With these in hand, they realize that thanks to digital technology, they could reinvigorate them and restore them.
Many photographers throw away their test prints. And so he just happened to stash them in a couple of boxes, and they were gone for a decade. And the family, of course, as Kareem said, you know, it was like losing him all over again. And then suddenly they find these boxes of test prints, and they don't look like Andy's photographs. They're weathered and they're faded and they're kind of a disaster, really. But, you know, Photoshop is magic. So it's a really great resurrection story.
You're listening to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. And this is a previous conversation that I had with Igor Sterenberg, executive director of the Miami Jewish Film Festival, and Dennis Scholl and Kareem Tapsch, both co-directors of the documentary The Last Resort.
You know, the other part of the story, though, that Dennis, that you had just touched on a moment ago, was the fact that, you know, eventually this story ends for this community, for the Jewish community. A big part of it is the fact that they just were aging and dying. When you think about this story and how it plays out and how Miami has changed, because really we see this change over all these decades, you know, what did Gary and Andy capture that was so special to you in your mind?
Well, the idea of being able to be in a what is basically a homogeneous community. You know, we live in a community that is very diverse. And that community down there was literally just elderly Jewish retirees, many blue-collar workers, postal workers, folks like that. And we don't live that way anymore in this community. Everybody, you know, it is such a diverse community, maybe one of the most diverse communities in America. So it's not easy to go and find a community like that anymore. You know, it was before civil rights, for example. You know, there were a lot of things that changed that have made our communities more open and less like, as Mitch Kaplan of Books and Books says in the film, less like a shtetl.
Igor, tell people real quickly, you know, being able to have the chance to watch The Last Resort, or also tell them about some of the other. You already said there's 60 films that are going to be shown, but are there a few that you point to, like this one, you say, don't miss this one at least?
Last Resort is an essential entry in our festival program, and I can't be any more thankful to Kareem and Dennis in them trusting us with this gem of a film. It's already sold out, so I really wish that your listeners would at least have the faith of a rush line and take the chances and play the gamble. Very well.
And by the way, tell them if they don't know what the rush line.
Rush line is you're basically playing with fate. You're hopeful that somebody's just not going to show up because they're stuck in traffic, that they're not going to show up to the screening, and you will be able to buy their seat.
That is a gamble. Mm-hmm. That's always a gamble. But are there a couple of other films or a couple other things, at least highlights of the upcoming festival, that you would say, at least don't miss this?
I kind of programmed this festival to myself. If I were looking at the program, I as a film lover and a watcher, what would excite me? And when I program the film festival this way, I know that there are some films that are going to be just really not to miss life experiences. One of these is the movie Film Worker. It's a story of Leon Vitali, this shadow figure, but, you know, the right hand of Stanley Kubrick, one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. And this documentary goes into the story of sacrifice of this one individual who basically gave up his entire life to the dream of another man. And you learn through this film just how instrumental, how absolutely pivotal Leon was to the success and to executing the vision of Stanley Kubrick's films.
And again, that's Igor Sterenberg, executive director of the Miami Jewish Film Festival. We also heard from Dennis Scholl and Kareem Tapsch, both co-directors of the documentary The Last Resort. We'll have more information on our website at WLRN.org. Don't forget that you can find us on iTunes. Just look up WLRN Sundial. That's the program for today. That's it for the week. I'm Luis Hernandez. I really appreciate your time. Always remember, find us online at WLRN.org. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.